Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WONI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's the most popular sport in the world. No other sport has the global scope, financial clout and mystical power that soccer has over its billions of fans. One American fan says that above all, soccer is the one sport that explains everything. Nationalism, religious rivalries, culture wars, globalization, everything. Tonight on Point, life, the universe, and soccer with superfan Franklin Foer. But first, a thin but defiant Saddam Hussein faced an Iraqi judicial hearing today when he was read seven preliminary charges against him. The former dictator was handcuffed when brought to court, but the shackles were removed for the 26-minute arraignment. It was the first public appearance by the Iraqi leader in the 7 months following his capture. Yochti Drezin is Baghdad correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him to describe how Iraqis reacted to seeing Saddam in court.
I think the reaction was almost evenly divided, something that's borne out both anecdotally and also by a somewhat unscientific poll. There were many people whose loathing of Saddam Hussein is such that they saw this as the first step to something that will end with him being publicly found guilty and ultimately executed. There were others who felt some degree of nostalgia for the relative stability inside the country when he was in power and for the fact that he was a leader they were familiar with. And now, of course, they're in a somewhat uncharted part of their history.
What did Iraqis make, though, of the way Saddam Hussein looked and indeed what he said?
We heard a lot of people say that although he was thinner, and although the mustache they remembered him having for all the years he ruled was now a beard, and although he also at times looked tired, that at base they recognized him vividly, that he had the same mix of emotions between anger and aggressiveness, the same ability to dominate a setting. They were struck by the fact that at many points of the hearing, the judge, who was relatively young, appeared to give way to a degree to Saddam, who was able to mold parts of the hearing towards the direction he wanted them to go down. And that was something that most Iraqis we spoke to were very struck by.
Would it be true to say that Saddam Hussein was at one and the same time defiant and downcast, perhaps?
Yeah, it would certainly be true to say that. You might even say that his emotions went along a very wide gamut, that they went from being at times downcast, dazed, even confused-looking, at times angry and aggressive, at times fierce-looking. And so his emotions really went from one to the other to the other, often in a non-linear way. So he'd be angry at one moment, calm the next, and angry again.
And the seven preliminary charges that were read out to him, is that what people expected?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. One is that these seven are, in many ways, the highest profile crimes he's accused of. The other is that they chose these crimes carefully to try to be balanced between Iraq's various ethnic groups. So they tried to pick some crimes that involved Kurds, others that involved Shias, others that were suffered by the country as a whole, so that all of the strands of Iraqi society could look at this and say that for all of them, this was an attempt at some kind of closure and some kind of justice.
But Saddam Hussein seemed to become most agitated when he was accused of invading Kuwait in 1990.
His reaction now, as has been often in the past, and he's been asked about it, is that Kuwait historically was part of Iraq, that Kuwait at the time of the invasion was Iraq's 19th province, and that, as he said today, he was trying to serve the Iraqi people through the invasion. His argument today, which he made kind of vividly, using language that ultimately drew a bit of a rebuke from the judge, was that the Kuwaitis, who he referred to as dogs, were in some ways trying to impoverish Iraq and to make Iraqi women into prostitutes.
Is it expected to be a problem that Saddam Hussein refused at the end of this hearing to sign legal papers confirming that he'd been read his rights and understood the case against him?
I think that what it might signify is more his anger and the anger, frankly, of others in Iraqi societies, not all of whom are strictly his supporters, at the fact that there was no lawyer of his present and no lawyer of his he was able to have access to during the hearing or even really an immediate run-up to the hearing. He didn't, during the hearing, say that he failed to recognize legitimacy of the court. He was actually rather courteous to the judge and several times said to him explicitly, "I respect judges." But he made what many might find to be a relatively fair point, which is that the judge had told him, "You're entitled to have a lawyer," and yet he did not have a lawyer.
And when is he expected back in court?
There's really no sign of it. The head of the tribunal, Sam Chalabi, has said for some time now that don't expect the Saddam Hussein trial to start anytime soon, that they were going to try to build the case from the bottom up, first with lower-level officers, then to mid-level officers, and only at the very end to get to Saddam Hussein and his closest aides. So it's very likely that the trial for Saddam, and even if the next sort of formal arraignment and indictment of Saddam, may be months, if not a year or so away.
Yochi Drizin, many, many thanks.
Thanks a lot.
And Yochi Drizin is a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Baghdad. You may be caught up in the drama of the latest Red Sox-Yankees series, but there's another sport that's captured the imagination of billions of people around the world, and no, it's not tennis at Wimbledon. Right now, all eyes are on Lisbon, Portugal, for Euro 2004. People are watching soccer.
It's hit upfield now by David James. Oh, and it's run as well. Oh, it's on tape! Oh, it scores! Oh, it's fixed it in brilliantly! What are you doing, David Rakeford? And it makes it enough for the line.
Zagorakis does really well, takes it past Lizarazu. Zagorakis into the penalty area, crosses now. Oh, Karastas has scored! And Greece have taken the lead! What a header from 12 yards! It's into
With Portugal so aware of Van Nistelrooy's presence, the helpless Andrade has conceded an own goal, and it's Portugal 2, Holland 1.
Con l'eccezionale Basinas su tutti I palloni arriva questo giocatore greco, davvero formidabile. Un incontrista.
If ever there was a moment for David Beckham to deliver one of his better free kicks, this is it. In he goes, headed against the bar. Campbell should be the goal. A goal!
C'est placé à côté de la zone d'avance. C'est parti au niveau du point de pénalty. La tête de Colère pour dégager de cette reprise de Karagouis à côté de la cage de Petrosèche et Sylvestre.
C'est un peu enflammé.
Perez got the last touch on it. And Greece had surely won the silver goal clincher in the semi-final of Euro 2004. Scores the most important goal of his life, maybe.
This is not good for anyone's heart. This really isn't.
It's like England, is it?
Passion indeed. Well, with its surprise semi-final win tonight, Greece looks forward to squaring off against Portugal on Sunday's final of the Euro 2004. Fans call soccer the beautiful game, a sport that's a perfect metaphor for life. Our guest tonight, American soccer fan and self-described maven, Franklin Foer, thinks the sport is even bigger than that. Soccer, he says, explains the world, from giant soccer stadiums in Manchester and Madrid to the smallest, dustiest pickup pitch in Cameroon and Calcutta. The sport illuminates the forces behind sectarianism, nationalism, and culture wars. Soccer, Foer says, explains everything. It is the globalized sport. Tonight on Point, how soccer explains the world. Are you a soccer fan? Is this a sport that explains nationalism, oligarchy, or globalization to you? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington and kind enough to turn himself away from coverage of the Euro 2004 is Franklin Foer, staff writer for The New Republic. His book is entitled How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Franklin Foer, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Julian, I assume based on your accent and your home nation's ugly performance, that was a pretty wrenching series of clips to have to relive.
Well, it was indeed. As the commentator said, it's bad for your heart. But turning to your book, it begins with the succinct phrase, "I suck at soccer," a reference to your childhood, I think.
It's a, I'm afraid, a sadly apt description of my abilities on the soccer pitch. I grew up playing the game, as many red-blooded young Americans have, on hallowed suburban fields, and I think I've managed to pretty much shut the most horrible memories out of my mind by this point. But I'm told by my parents that when I was on the field, I would have such tendencies as running in the opposite direction of the ball. And because I felt so much shame as a result of my calamities on the field, I think I ended up doing what nerdy guys tend to do when they stink at sports, which is that they intellectualize it. And so to overcome my shame, to put that behind me, I tried to achieve some mastery over the game.
So you're a lot better now. You're a lot better at watching soccer than you are at playing it. Just give us some sense, if you would, of just how big soccer is now around the world.
It's everywhere. I mean, there was it really is the single most globalized phenomenon on the planet, and getting even more globalized every day as it hooks up with multinational corporations and becomes part of global media ever more deeply. And you know, there are parts of the world like like North America, the Indian subcontinent, Australia, which have managed to resist soccer largely to this point, and have had their own indigenous sports. But even that's starting to disappear. Places like Australia and New Zealand, soccer has really come on strong. And in the United States, I think that while there hasn't been the soccer revolution that a lot of people are continually predicting, I think that there's a slow, steady accumulation of successes for the game. And the fact that so many little kids play the game is very gradually translating into adult fans.
And billions of dollars slushing around in this game. But how did you get the idea of putting together globalization and soccer?
Basically, as I was sitting on my couch in the mid-1990s, I realized that it was suddenly so much easier to follow what was going on in Europe. You could read the British papers on the internet. There was a channel that suddenly appeared in the mid-90s called Fox Sports World, which carried games from pretty much everywhere. And I could see myself personally being caught up in a process of globalization. And so there was this intersection between what I was experiencing as a fan and what I was working on as a journalist here in Washington as globalization became really a major topic of conversation and debate.
So you then took off to try to put your theory to the test.
That's right. I mean, I wanted to use the game as kind of a laboratory for studying globalization. Because it was so much more advanced in the process of globalization, I thought it would be very interesting to use it as kind of a metaphor and as a way of testing what politics, economics, and culture would end up looking like in the age of globalization. So I took off 8 months from my job at the New Republic, and I went traveling mostly as an excuse to go see the stadiums and games I'd always wanted to see, but secondarily searching globalization. And so each chapter in my book tells a story from a different country, and each story has a different lesson about politics and economics and culture.
Okay, well, we're going to have a bit of a closer look at some of those chapters, some of your stories, and some of them, I have to say, are a little scary. Franklin, do stay with us. We're talking tonight with Franklin Foer about how soccer explains the world. What is it about the sport that raises such passion, fervor, or even violence in its fans? Have you ever been in a fever pitch over soccer? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.
Lets it bounce. Vassell's got control. Vassell feeds Wayne Rooney. It wasn't well delivered by Vassell, but Rooney's in the area. Get the shot in, Wayne Rooney. And it's gone in off the goalkeeper. And this
is Wayne's World. England 2, Switzerland 0. The first victory of Euro 2004.
I'm Julian Marshall, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight to Franklin Foer, staff writer for The New Republic and author of the new book, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Can soccer or sports be a force for social and economic change in the era of globalization? Have sports like soccer lost their local traditions and local appeal? Or when David Beckham plays for Madrid for $41 million and Freddy Adu stars with Pele in an American soft drink commercial, is it just a sign of our globalized times? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight with Franklin Foer about how soccer explains the world. Does soccer today reinforce old-fashioned nationalism? Franklin Foer, still with us. You say that the first part of your book is hooligan heavy, and you travel for more evidence of that to Serbia and the Serb paramilitary Arkan, who managed to harness a bunch of football fans to his cause. Tell me more.
There's a club in Belgrade called Red Star, and in 1991, they were the champions of Europe. And at the same time, they achieved this tremendous success on the field. Their fan clubs were being mobilized by the Milosevic regime to be basically the foot soldiers in the war in Bosnia. And basically, the idea was that these were guys who were hooligans who fought every weekend at the soccer game, and they were perfectly, you know, all you need to do is basically stick them in a different context, give them guns, and they would be the perfect irregular army who could go and do the dirty work that they either for public relations reasons didn't want the regular army to do, or because the regular army had a whole different set of ethics and mores, wasn't going to sign up for the task. And so this club, these fan clubs, these supporters of Red Star, ended up going rampaging through Bosnia in the early 90s. And the president of this fan club, the guy who was put in charge of transitioning them from being a normal bunch of hooligans into being a hooligan army servicing the cause of genocide, was the war criminal Arkan, who is really the most notorious of the Serb war criminals.
And what was he tapping into, Arkan, with these football fans, these soccer fans?
Well, these guys were for starters. Nationalist to begin with. Their club had always been a repository for Serb national aspirations, so he was certainly tapping into that. And then secondly, he was just tapping into the culture of hooliganism in Serbia, that even before he turned them into an army, they'd gone into Croatia to play Dinamo Zagreb, the big Croatian soccer club. And, you know, without any prompting, really, these guys had gone to war against the fans of Dinamo Zagreb in a famous game in I think it was 1990, if I'm recalling correctly. And so it was just incredibly easy to translate this behavior from one context to another. It didn't take a whole lot of reorganizing and prodding to turn them into the monsters that they became.
I mean, this is an instance of soccer explaining the gangster's paradise, in this case, Arkan. But does it explain the Balkans conflict?
I think it does, because There's one way of understanding the Balkans conflict that I think is incredibly widespread, which is that this was really just a bunch of ethnic groups who've hated each other for time immemorial, and we were just witnessing these atavistic ancient hatreds playing themselves out to their logical conclusion. And, you know, of course, those ancient hatreds existed, and that's one of the prime ways of explaining the conflict. But there was something else that was at work here, which was that, you know, you had a national culture that was taken over by an ethos of gangsterism. And I think it's important to look at where that ethos of gangsterism came from. And in the case of these hooligans, really the worst war criminals, the ones who committed the real atrocities, they were they looked towards the hooligans in Western Europe. They very carefully studied the behavior and the fashions of the English soccer hooligans, the Italian soccer fan clubs. Their favorite form of music was African American gangster rap. They paid very careful attention to the emerging Russian mafia, and so I think that you can argue, and I do argue that. Part of what happened in the Balkans was that this international culture of gangsterism was globalized. That, you know, it's not just the good things that get globalized. It's not just the things that elevate people's standards of living in goods, and there are also bad things that get globalized. And this was one of the most grim examples of the bad parts of culture spreading.
And you dug up some more of these atavistic hatreds in the religious rivalries between two Scottish football teams, Celtic and Rangers. Tell me more.
That's right. Glasgow in Scotland, one of the great industrial cities of the British Empire, has two clubs. One is called Celtic, and they are the Irish Catholic club. And the other is called Rangers, and they are the Scottish Protestant club. And when these two teams meet, which is about usually four times a year, their games are essentially a way of hashing out unresolved issues from the Protestant Reformation. When Rangers play, most of their songs are rife with sectarian intent. They're songs that you know refer to Finian bastards. One of the rituals that I found most bizarre was that before games, the at their stadium, the loudspeaker would play Tina Turner's "Simply the Best," and 40,000 Rangers Protestant fans would culminate the song by screaming vile insults at the Pope. And on the flip side, the Celtic fans sing songs about the potato famine, and their stands are filled with banners praising the IRA. And I found this rivalry to be peculiar in really, I thought, complicated a lot of the very dominant theories about globalization, that Scotland was supposed to be part of Europe. It's advanced, it's capitalist, it's, you know, as Western as they come, it's the birthplace of the Enlightenment. And yet, despite all this, people continue to indulge in this atavistic, ancient, tribal rivalry. And you could say, well, isn't this just sport? Isn't this just people playing? And, you know, that's true to an extent, but there are people that die quite regularly as a result of this rivalry in Glasgow.
And these rivalries are not simply about what you say, but also what you wear.
Exactly. One of the great heroes for the Rangers, for the Protestant team, is a figure they refer to as King Billy, who is William of Orange, who is, of course, the man who retook the monarchy from the Catholics. And to commemorate William of Orange, the Rangers fans wear orange jerseys, and they sing about the Battle of the Boyne, one of the most decisive battles King Billy ended up fighting. And, you know, and people get killed for wearing the wrong colors. There are loads of recent examples of guys wearing the green and white hoops jersey of Celtic getting mauled and killed and shot by crossbows for no other reason than the shirt on their backs and what it symbolizes.
We're talking to Franklin Foer about how soccer explains the world. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frank, very much though, the downside, if you like, of globalization, the way in which it's revived tribalism, the two cases that you've given, certainly in the Balkans and indeed in that rivalry in Glasgow.
That's right. I mean, one of the interesting things to me was I wanted to look at how people would identify themselves in this age of globalization using soccer, because you have the rise of these multinational conglomerates. Like, I'm speaking metaphorically here, but not by much. Like Manchester United and Real Madrid, and these guys are backed by Nike and Adidas, and they have hundreds of millions of dollars at their disposal, and they set out to take fans and ply them away from their old-time local allegiances and turn them into Manchester United and Real Madrid fans. And they've set out to build international empires. So both Manchester United and Real Madrid regularly tour Asia and in North America, seeking to break into these new markets. And what I found was that, yes, Manchester United and Real Madrid have had some success in executing this project. But on the other hand, they've had far less success than I think that you would expect, and far less success if we're working through this globalization metaphor than both the critics and the supporters of globalization tend to talk about when they're executing their theories. And so I was just so impressed at how the local is so durable, that the local rivalries, the local customs, the local corruptions, all these local entities, institutions, mores have really managed to survive. And even more than that, they seem to be exacerbated to an extent by the phenomenon of globalization, that as nation states become less powerful, as multinational corporations become more powerful, people end up clinging more tightly to their old identities.
All over the world, though, teams playing in leagues, soccer leagues, now have more and more foreign players. I mean, does that combat or foster nationalism, do you think?
Right. Well, let's take the Rangers example. Rangers is the Protestant team in Glasgow, and they regularly field. Well, let me just step back for a minute. Up through the late 1980s, Rangers never had a Catholic player on their team. And they didn't just have a ban on Catholic players. They had a ban on hiring Catholic executives. And they wouldn't hire Catholic janitors. And they wouldn't hire Protestants, in some cases, who'd married Catholics. And that changed in the late 1980s when they hired Mo Johnston, their first Catholic player. And now their team is often majority Catholic, and not just Scottish Catholics, guys from Spain and Argentina who are really, you know, as Catholic as they come. And despite this foreign presence and despite the multiculturalism that you'd see on the field, it hasn't changed the fans' feelings at all, and it hasn't really done anything to alleviate the worst, most tribalistic parts of the rivalry.
Franklin, more on that in a moment, but let's just take a call from Seamus. He's calling from Hoboken, New Jersey. What did you want to say, Seamus?
First of all, I'd just like to make a comment regarding the Celtic Rangers. I think you've made a very good analysis of a very complex situation. But my actual question is actually in relation to America and America's soccer team. America, sometimes the soccer team is somewhat young and has great potential to become a major player in the international soccer scene. But how would you relate that to America's sometimes what could be perceived as isolationist in terms of the political or the current affairs scene? America tends to go things its own way, where a lot of other countries, mainly European countries, tend to have maybe better soccer teams, but they also tend to have more of an international awareness. America doesn't seem to have that yet, but I think it probably will have in a number of years.
Franklin Foer, you didn't actually get onto that, I don't think, in your book. American foreign policy, unilateralism, multilateralism, going through a unilateral phase at the moment, perhaps less susceptible, therefore, to the influence of international soccer.
Well, America, you know, I when you look at the failure of soccer to really catch on in the United States, I don't think you can draw any sort of clean connections to our foreign policy or towards our attitude towards the world. I mean, after all, it was we had a lot of immigrants who came to the country with the game. And, you know, I think that the game had a genuine opportunity to take off in the early part of the 20th century. And the reason that it didn't take off has a lot more to do with the people who were running the leagues and their failure to get their act together. And so when you get to the 1920s, the moment where American mass culture is formed by radio, by newsreels, baseball, football, they've got their act together and they flourish in the new mass culture. And soccer, you know, unfortunately didn't have its act together at that time and kind of got confined to an ethnic ghetto in this country for a long time, and then was associated primarily with little kids and the women's game, which is wonderful, but I think has done a lot to kind of prejudice.
Okay, Franklin, we've got a lot of calls stacking up on that question of America and soccer, and we'll come to back to them in a moment. But I just want to get back to that point of foreign players. I mean, and an English football fan turning out, say, for one of the top English teams, say like Chelsea, will maybe see, I don't know, four or five Englishmen on the pitch, and the rest of them from another country or another country's. Now, what's happening there, do you think? Just briefly.
I mean, I think that this is the way that globalization is supposed to work, that you you go out and you find the best talent available regardless of national boundaries. You know, I think that there's almost a fetish for that's happened in the last 10 years, that you go to a lot of places and there's this almost mystical belief that if you bring in foreign players into your squad, you're suddenly going to be vastly improved. And, you know, I think that this is one more way in which the game works as a good metaphor for globalization, that there was kind of this euphoria about the idea of globalization. In some cases, people got carried away with it and stopped to evaluate the...
Do stay with us.
Sure.
Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point.
Flick forward by Pigo to Nuno Gomes on the edge of the Spanish penalty. Turns, shoots, scores! And the Portuguese bench hair onto the field down below us. And the Jose Alvalade Stadium erupts. And Portuguese fans leap into the air in ecstasy.
I'm Julian Marshall, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight to Franklin Foer, staff writer for The New Republic and author of the new book, How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. What does soccer explain about the world to you? In a world rapidly globalized by political and economic forces, what about the social and cultural globalization of sports like soccer? Is it positive, negative, or both? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Franklin, let's move on. as your book does, to Latin America and Pelé, arguably one of the greatest Brazilian players of all time, and the story of capitalism in Brazil. Describe what his story says about economic development in a newly freed country.
Pelé, in addition to being the legendary player, was a actual government minister in Brazil in the mid 1990s. He was the minister of sport, and he came into office promising to really reform the Brazilian game. For a long time, it had been controlled by really corrupt guys, and who ran the game in kind of the classic mode of Latin American crony capitalism, which is to say, not very capitalistic. And so he wanted to institute this whole kind of IMF-like series of reforms to make the clubs more capitalistic, to really open them up to foreign investment. And foreign investment indeed ended up pouring into Brazilian soccer. You had German media conglomerates, you had Dallas-based pension funds all investing tremendous amounts of money in the Brazilian game. But what ended up happening is that that money didn't transform the game. It was just swallowed up by the old corrupt guys who ran the game before. And they basically took the money from the foreign investors and then stole it and then started complaining about how the foreign investors were destroying local Brazilian customs and traditions and ruining the Brazilian game. And poor Pelé ended up getting caught up in his own corruption scandal. He was accused of bilking UNICEF of $700,000, skimming it off of a benefit tournament that he was supposed to have arranged. And there are all sorts of other charges that get leveled against Pelé, that he had conflicts of interest as he was reforming the game. And so the takeaway lesson from this story for me was the way in which foreign investment had failed to transform Brazilian game, even though so much of it was coursing through the system. And that was because the local corrupt guys were tapping into something deep within Brazilian culture, that they were tapping into deep anxieties that people had about the foreign investors. And there was a weird way in which they had kind of an organic connection to their constituencies. And so, I think one of the things that people are always so optimistic about the benefits of foreign investment, and I tend to be very optimistic about them myself, but I'm not quite as optimistic about them as a lot of the proponents.
Okay, Frank.
Let's just
take a call from Theo in Wakefield, Massachusetts, and I think probably his view is probably that of a lot of people of soccer and the international game. Theo?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to jump back to the point you were making about soccer and hooliganism and violence. It seems ironic to me that with globalization, reducing barriers and bringing more people together and perhaps diluting cultures, it seems that it's actually perhaps been more divisive and been easy to inflame partisanship and sort of national rivalries, and hasn't necessarily mollified contact, but perhaps increased it.
Franklin Foer, what's your verdict overall in the course of your travels on that?
No, I completely agree with what Theo just said. I mean, that's one of the main arguments of my book, that instead of making everybody get along, in this instance, I found that globalization, it's got a lot of great tendencies, but it's also, in some instances, in some circumstances, had the tendency that Theo describes to exacerbate tribalism and conflict.
Where is its potential, though, for making a better world, soccer?
I found it really in the Middle East. A very good example is Iran. And every time that Iran plays a major World Cup match or World Cup qualifying match, people come out into the streets to either celebrate or to express their grave disappointment. And in these moments of euphoria or disappointment, people tend to say what they really think about the regime, and it's usually not nice about the regime. And my argument is that it's not just the moment of euphoria that leads people to do this. There's something about the national team itself that in the history of the Middle East, you have these two competing political strains. You have secular nationalism and you've got political Islam. And in a way, the soccer has always been identified with the idea of secular nationalism, that the national team itself has an idea of what a Middle Eastern nation could be independent of Islam. And there's something inherently secular in the game in that it ends up almost inevitably connecting people to Western Europe and the rest of the soccer playing world. And if you follow the game, you're inevitably going to see pictures of David Beckham with his ever changing haircut and all these sorts of things have an idea of freedom in inherent in it. And the regime tries to suppress coverage of soccer. They try to blot out advertisements on the side of the field, which may advertise products that aren't available in Iran, therefore advertising a way of life that's not available in Iran. And they do all sorts of other things to try to suppress the game. But there's only so much that you can do to suppress it. And okay. I think inevitably it helps introduce an idea of freedom and another idea of what a Middle Eastern nation can be that's you know, in the end of the day, pretty subversive.
Okay, so that's soccer then as a force for potential good in a country like Iran. But overall, right. In the course of your travels, soccer a force for good? You've got some pretty hairy stories in there.
I think, you know, I think that soccer is such a multi-variant phenomenon that you can't reduce it to being a force for good or a force for ill. I think that in some instances it gets used as a force for ill, and you know those are very graphic instances, but they're also relatively rare ones. And I think that the game as a whole, you know, it's on balance probably a force for good.
Franklin Foer, staff writer for The New Republic and author of the new book, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Many thanks for being with us this hour. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, one of soccer's biggest stars bows out. This is On Point. One of the stars of soccer took part in his last international match today, and we're not talking about some impervious goalie or a high-scoring striker. We're talking about Pierluigi Collina, the Italian widely considered the greatest referee in the world.
Pierluigi Collina, the Italian referee, what a treasure it is to have him. Great referee, best in the world.
And now the two teams shake the hands of the officials. Pierluigi Collina, the best referee in the world, indisputably in charge of this match.
Interestingly, when he came out to have a wander around the pitch, they were chanting his name.
It's Michael Owen, brought down, wasn't he, in the area? Collina's there, the referee, and the penalty's been given.
The referee, it isn't a question of whether he is the best in the world or not, he is. Collina.
Well, Collina officiated one of the semi-finals of the Euro 2004 soccer tournament, won earlier today 1-0 by Greece. Because he's reached age 45, Collina will now be forced to retire from international matches. Seamus Mallon is a soccer commentator for ESPN. I asked him how a referee, generally considered the most hated position in sports, has managed to become an international celebrity.
It is peculiar, isn't it? Who would have thought a referee, of all people, the most mocked individual, usually by fans and players alike, should suddenly be a cult figure, and a popular cult figure at that? Sometimes people say, well, he's so well-liked because he's so easily recognized, and he is such a peculiar character. He looks like he stepped off a Hollywood set from E.T. or something. But actually, I think, in large part, his great success is because he has been a referee who has manifested a deep knowledge of what it means to be a player and what it means to be a fan without letting the emotions of those two affect his decisions. I mean, he clearly gives the impression of somebody who knows exactly what players are going through and what the fans see, and is able to convey with a nod or a wink or a grin that he knows what's going on in addition to just adjudicating fouls.
But a good soccer referee, by definition, is supposed to be one who's not noticed, and yet here's this man with a completely bald head, bulging eyes and cadaverous face.
Yes.
He stands out, doesn't he?
He does stand out, but sometimes referees also stand out for the wrong reasons, and that is they stand out by being excessively demonstrative and sort of taking over like showmen. He doesn't do that. He has this kind of aura placed upon him by the fans and the players because of what I said a moment ago, that they do sense that while he seems a rather charming and unusual character, he nonetheless has an unusual degree of insight and just plain wisdom that he manages to manifest in a very sort of insider way.
And is that what sets him apart from other soccer referees?
Well, I think some of the rest of them do have it, but they sometimes do it in a kind of schoolmasterish way, you know, wagging fingers and lecturing people and getting in the faces of players. And he doesn't do any of that sort of thing. He doesn't impose himself as a nasty kind of martinet in the match, but he gives a little a wink or a nod, and the players know right away, oh, okay, I'm not going to pull anything on this fellow. And the fans say, oh, right, he's not going to let anybody pull anything on him. We're all for him. And it takes a lot to get a fan to acknowledge that.
Do you have a favorite Kalina anecdote or game moment?
I've just been watching him in the first half here of the match he's doing tonight. In the match this evening, you could see one situation where two Greek players in the very first few minutes went into sort of demonstrative rolling about on the ground, and he just sort of looked down at them with that look of, surely you don't think I'm going to fall for that. And then the grin came out over the player's face, and they said, right, maybe we'll just keep playing. And that sort of typifies what he conveys. I can think of tons of times when I've seen him pull that off, and you just have to applaud it and love it.
Why is the man who is arguably the most famous soccer referee of the past two decades stepping down at the top of his game?
Well, it's because he's being forced to. It's not his choice. He has reached the age when, under the regulations in UEFA and in FIFA, that he can no longer be permitted to referee top-level matches. To those of us who admire him, that's a nonsense. He's an eminently fit, very wise, and he should keep refereeing for at least three or four more years. And actually, the hot rumor is, Julian, that he may leave Italy and go referee in the Premiership in England, where they don't have quite as rigid an age restriction.
So there's going to be plenty more opportunities, you're saying, for Kalina to blow his whistle.
Well, I mean, if he accepts this, whether or not he will do it is another question, but it's remarkable to hear, you know, English fans saying, oh, we'd love to have him. I mean, can you imagine English fans, football fans saying, we'd love to have this referee? Normally, they're lining up the adjectives to dismiss him before a ball's kicked in anger. But they would welcome him, and that speaks volumes about how much he's respected.
Seamus Mallon, many thanks.
You're welcome.
Seamus Mallon is a soccer commentator for ESPN. He joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Chopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamar Murad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schifflin, with help from Michael Garth, Darren Manoogian, and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.